Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
You're listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Nicole Taylor. Today, we'll be talking the secret financial life of food. But first up, all of the Thanksgiving photos. Okay, guys, so Mashable.com posted a piece from Instagram's blog. Do you know that 10 million photos were uploaded on Thanksgiving Day via Instagram? Were you one of those folks? They're saying that they beat the record. Their first record was set during Superstorm Sandy, where millions of people uploaded photos. But more than 10 million photos were uploaded mentioning the word Thanksgiving and other related words. They're basically saying every 10 seconds, around 200 photos were uploaded to the photo sharing site. Okay, I'm guilty. I was like addicted to uploading photos on Instagram during Thanksgiving break. So I wonder if the same thing will happen during Christmas and during Hanukkah and all these other festive holidays that are going on. But anyway, I hope everyone had a great Thanksgiving. I am just so excited about the next few shows on Hot Grease because they're going to be all very festive, talking about, you know, good cheer. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come back and talk good cheer and money and all that good stuff with Kara Newman. Keep listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Bang Bang Sun by Iggy Dean on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. All right, folks, it's the time. I know today is Cyber Monday, and I'm sure some of you folks have been spending tons of money on items that are non-food. But today on Hot Grease, we're going to talk the secret financial life of food with Kara Newman. Karen's in the studio. Kara.
Hey.
Welcome back to Hot Grease.
Thank you.
I'm so glad to have you back in the studio. You were here, I think, on episode like 22 or something back when during your first book, but you're here. Talk your new title, The Secret Financial Life of Food, and not cocktails today. So again, welcome.
Maybe next time.
So I have to ask you, when I read this book, started reading the book, I'm like, wait, did I not know this about Kara? I had no clue that you were in like the commodity financial world before transitioning to spirits.
Oh, yeah. I had a whole other life before I started doing this.
So what did you actually do before?
Before I did this, I was vice president of strategic research at Thomson Financial.
Oh, wow.
Does that sound fancy?
Quite fancy. So you were into food, though, and cocktails then, right?
Not at first, no. I was actually very serious about writing about stocks and bonds and commodities for a while, and the food part came much, much later.
So you tell the story in the very beginning about you taking a class. I guess you were taking some kind of course outside of your job, and you guys came to a part about commodities or all these traded goods. Is that where you like, maybe I can write a whole book about commodities and food?
I don't think I was even thinking that way, but it's interesting. That was a big part of of the transition for me because at the time I was working with a team and I was given this task to create a commodities update for clients. And I didn't know that much about commodities, so I took a class to try to learn as much as I could. And we were given these enormous course books explaining what commodities are and what trades as a commodity. And in between all the different pages about oil futures and gold futures and S&P futures, and I'm falling asleep. You're probably falling asleep. We came to a page that was all about food-related futures, cocoa futures and soybean futures. And it was really an epiphany for me. All of a sudden, I thought of it as a menu, and a lot of things really started to click into place.
So I have to ask you, so I know some people are listening, they're like, commodities, oh, I know what it is, but really? Do you really know? What is the definition of commodities? When I hear that word, I think Wall Street, I think items. What's the layperson's term to the word commodities?
Well, you're not that far off, but as opposed to stocks, commodities really are just a promise to buy or to sell a particular item, a very specific grade, a very specific quantity. So quantity and quality. So you're going to buy, you promise to deliver this amount of this grade of corn or oil or gold or silver at a particular date.
So if we look at commodities now, if we went on the internet or bought your book and looked through, and we're trying to figure out what are the top food commodities right now, what will we find?
Definitely soybeans and definitely corn. Those are the number one and number two.
Really? And so if we go back 100 years ago, what will we find in terms of top commodities?
I think you'd find grain, number one grain. So
interesting.
Wheat. And also, you also have to think about 100 years ago, where was the country, you know, where was the population? You didn't really have the West Coast as populated.
So yeah, we're talking what, 1912?
Right. So you really had very, not exclusively an East Coast population, but you really had a lot of people here. You had the Midwest where they were growing all of the grains. You had the railroad bring people back and forth. It was still kind of new.
Interesting, interesting. So I'm thinking commodities. I hear the word soybean. We were talking 100 years ago. I hear the word grain, and I'm hearing corn and soybeans. What is the direct connection to commodities, those two top commodities of right now and supermarkets today, and what's being sold in supermarkets?
Well, there's a connection with every product between what's sold in commodities markets and what's sold in supermarkets, but it's not necessarily a direct connection. What you have is a whole lot of middlemen between the producer who's growing the corn and the person at the supermarket who's buying the corn, and the people who are doing all the trading in between. You have people who are hedging their bets, who are bringing the corn from the immediate producer to whoever's going to be processing the corn, from whoever is processing the corn to whoever's going to be selling it and distributing it to the different supermarkets, and from those distributors to the markets themselves. And it's important not so much because of how it trades, at least in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
What's really important, I think, is the end result of the pricing. All these back and forth transactions, that's what results in what we pay at the supermarket. It's this important... it's a price mechanism. That's what really is so important.
So the people in the middle, there are a lot of people in the middle, huh?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So they're determining how the things are swaying from supermarket to grower.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. So we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to dig deeper into some of the super cool themes in your book, In the Secret Life. Secret Financial Life of Food with Kara Newman. We'll be right back.
This one's called Onions Milk by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org.
following is a message from the Heritage Meat Shop.
Are you tired of just hearing buzzwords? Do you want to actually take part in the food revolution? Then come on down to the Heritage Meat Shop, located in New York's historic Essex Street Market, on the corner of Essex and Delancey. We have rare breed pork, beef, poultry, lamb, and goat, not to mention charcuterie that'll make you squeal. All raised right, by the right people, so you know they'll taste right. Try the meat that over 100 New York chefs ache for. Come to the Heritage Meat Shop and pick up some revolution today.
For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com.
Welcome back, listeners, to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. We have Kara Newman in the studio, and we're chatting the secret financial life of food. So, Kara, after I read, you know, the book, and sir, I'm almost done, but I was like, I need to get me a t-shirt that says the butter and egg woman. I love in the term the stories about the butter and egg man. I had no clue that it was like a big deal.
That's do one of my tell. Favorite chapters too.
Do tell.
Okay, so the butter and egg man. I wanted one of those t-shirts too that says butter and egg woman.
I know, right?
We could make a lot of money off of that.
I mean, after, you know, using about 3 or 4 pounds of butter at Thanksgiving, I totally need that, right?
So the butter and egg man. There is, I mean, at heart, these are really just men who are, of course, selling butter and eggs. They were the guys who were in the warehouse. They would be bringing the butter and, of course, the eggs in from the farmland. They'd have the bushels of eggs cushioned in oats brought into the city to sell. But they were also the traders who would walk down from their stores every morning to the red brick building where they would set the prices for butter and eggs every day. But what I think is so interesting about the butter and egg man, it's not only that they set the prices, but that they became such a huge part of the cultural lexicon at the time.
Yeah.
They were immortalized in a play in the 1920s.
Really?
It was called the Butter and Egg Man, and it was about this Midwestern sucker who was taken for a ride by the city slickers from the East Coast. And after that, the Butter and Egg Man really became kind of a stock character. He was considered someone who was a philanderer. He was naive. He had a taste for bottle blondes.
Oh, wow. Hilarious.
And the play did really well, and it went on the road, and it didn't necessarily sit well with everyone, this stereotype of the butter and egger as being someone who was wealthy and a free spender and not very bright. And actually, when the play came to Minneapolis, one of the butter and egg men sued the theater.
Wow.
Because they didn't like being portrayed in this manner.
So they were kind of, I guess my depiction or what I'm thinking, that they were kind of prestigious guys. Supposedly they held a lot of power. No?
I guess it depends on who it was, but they generally were hardworking guys. A lot of them were quite well to do. They were comfortable. And there was a joke that the butter and egg man's wives were so fat because they used to butter their bread on both sides.
Oh my gosh, that is hilarious. We totally need a shirt for that, right? You know, one of the other things I love, I think a lot of people forget about the whole thing with sugar, coffee, and cocoa. And you have a great chapter about sugar, coffee, and cocoa. I can't remember any of the stories out of the sugar, coffee, and cocoa. But you definitely lay out in a very lay term. And I have to say this book is not like, you know, for, you know, this academic person. I love that you have the great stories like the butter and egg story. Do you have any stories for the coffee, sugar, and cocoa?
Well, I don't know if they're quite as salacious, but I'm so glad to re-say that because I do think that when it comes to these books, they don't have to be dry. They are all about stories. They're all about people. And especially when you're talking about the markets, you get a lot of people who are often in situations where they have lots of money. And one of the themes across the book, for better or for worse, is that when people have access to that much money, there's often a lot of greed. There's a lot of scandal. There's scandals all throughout the book, ranging from Tino DeAngelis and the great soybean scandal that reads almost like a cloak and dagger spy novel to the great grain traders who really tried to torpedo each other on the floor. But when it comes to the mochaccino markets, as I like to refer to them.
Is that your, you came up with that, mochaccino market?
I did.
I love did. It.
Thanks. One of my addictions, mochaccinos. But what I think is so unique about that market, just about every other chapter in the book is about products that are grown here. And not one of those is grown here. They're all products that are imported. You have coffee coming from the from South America and the Caribbean areas. You have sugar coming from the same areas. You have cocoa coming from elsewhere. Not one of them is grown here. So it really sets up to be a very New York story.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say, because I forget. There was another book recently that was out that kind of talked about the history of New York City and food. And I remember they were actually on the show talking about sugar and New York City and how... you know, in the early, I guess, 1800s or whenever, that the trading and selling sugar and all this stuff. I think that's a really, I think people forget about that, about, you know, sugar and how New York City at one point was really the dominating force in that whole trading it and getting to other people. I don't know what happened, huh? Why it's not like that anymore, or is it?
I think that New York is still very much the center of commodities trading and most financial markets. But I feel like now you have these twin markets. You've got Chicago, and you've got all the cattle trading and the grain trading, and then you have a lot of the stuff that isn't grown here, the coffee, sugar, and cocoa, and orange juice markets. Those trade here in New York, as opposed to the others that mostly trade in Chicago. I mean, Chicago is really where you want to be if you want to be a commodities trader these days.
Interesting. Very interesting. So when I think about this book, and based on what you just said, and if I'm listening to this show or pick up your book, if, you know, we have a lot of small food business owners that listen to the show, and even consumers, they're like, okay, I hear this, but how does this really affect me? I had no clue. You're saying Chicago. I didn't even know. So people can actually read maybe the Chicago Tribune and go to the business section and see what's going on there and maybe get some indicators if they're interested in starting some kind of business, huh?
Chicago is the place. And it's now, as about a month ago, it's the only place that's going to still have a trading floor. You can go and see everything in action. The Intercontinental Exchange, which is what used to be the New York Exchange, they stopped doing what they call open outcry. You can no longer go down and see the traders shouting and yelling at each other and making those gestures across the room. It's all going electronic now. It's fading away. When you want to talk about the difference between 100 years ago and now, now people are in their offices, in front of their computers. The trading pits are quiet. It's no longer up to your ankles and paper trading tickets. A lot of the drama, I think, has gone out of it.
Interesting. Very interesting. Speaking of drama, I don't know if you remember this headline. About 2 months ago, or maybe longer, there is all over the buzz, all over the interweb, saying that there's going to be a pork bacon shortage. You remember seeing that?
I do.
What did you think when you saw that? What did you think? And is it true? What does that mean?
It's not true. It was a pork shortage scare. Sorry. I don't mean to take the drama out of that either. But I have to admit, my heart kind of skipped a beat when I thought there was going to be no bacon. I think a lot of people really were very worried. But it's interesting. I mean, it actually proves a lot of points because it made me think a lot about the pork belly market.
Yeah, I was about to say, wasn't pork belly like one of the commodities that were being traded for a while and it stopped or something?
That's right. It traded for 50 years, almost to the day, and then, you know, gone.
Why?
Because it was no longer needed anymore. The thing about the commodities markets is that it thrives on volatility. We no longer trade eggs, but eggs were a really active market when we had a lot of seasonal volatility. And it was going to be hot in the summer. You needed to stockpile your eggs. And in the winter, they'd be scarce and you could charge a lot of money for it. And that's the makings of a great market. And same thing with the pork industry. Now, between advances in how pigs are grown and, yeah. and slaughtered and refrigeration and all the pork packing technologies, that the bloodless phrase for slaughter and dismemberment.
Very interesting.
Now there's no longer the volatility. So there's no longer a need to trade. There's no longer money to be made, which is kind of a sad statement on what the priorities are in the commodities markets. And there just isn't that need to hedge that volatility for the middlemen. So little by little, there was less and less volume. And one day the pork market just faded away. And that was the end of the iconic pork belly market.
So what does that mean? People are not making money anymore off of trading and selling.
It means they're just not making profits. You need a lot of volatility in the market. You need to be able to buy low and sell high and, you know, have lots and lots of turnover.
So I take that bit of information as like, huh, y'all, pork belly is kind of gone out of style. People, like all the restaurants, I even think about it, like the last 3 or 4 years, everyone was like a pork belly, pork belly, pork belly. You could barely get it at some restaurants. And then all of a sudden, everyone has pork bellies, pork belly tacos or whatever. I don't know if that has any correlation, but I'm like, yeah, maybe it does.
It did for a while. In the 2000s, the first decade, when pork bellies were still trading relatively actively, there was actually a big pickup because you were getting pork belly sold on so many restaurant menus. The demand went up. I mean, yeah. Really spiked.
Yeah. Very interesting. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to come back and talk the future. What does this all mean? What does this mean for our holiday shopping? The Secret Financial Life of Food with Kara Newman on Hot Grease today. Keep listening.
We've got more Iggy Dean. This one's called Written from the Pantheon on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Remember, you can listen to all of my shows right on heritageradionetwork.org. Let me give a Southern Girl's hug to Roberta's Restaurant located at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, New York. The location of two sustainable shipping containers known as Heritage Radio Network. Today's show was produced by myself and being engineered by the fabulous Joe G. If you're just tuning in, we're talking The Secret Financial Life of Food with Kara Newman. Kara, so you keep hearing this whole word fiscal cliff. Have you been seeing that word on CNN? And
sounds scary.
Yeah, what the hell does that mean? Does this mean anything for food and commodities, or do we even know?
Well, I can tell you what I do know, and that's that we are not likely to see food prices going down anytime soon.
Boo.
Sorry. I know. I'm not telling you anything you really want to hear.
Yeah. Hey, I think we've been talking about that for a while. That's been elevating over the last year, wouldn't we say?
Absolutely. No doubt. It really all comes back to supply and demand, which sounds a little dull. But then when you think about it in terms of human terms, it's about the fact that we might not have enough food to feed people. And we have essentially a population growth, really explosive growth, especially in the emerging markets, and there might not be enough food to feed everyone. It's really quite frightening. And what that says for food prices, you know, it's that basic supply demand. There's not enough for everyone. Prices are going to go up. And I mean, that's really the long and the short of it.
Yeah. And speaking of emerging, I mean, you've basically told us the top two food commodities that are traded as soybeans and corn. So the future markets, what should folks expect in the next, you know, few years in terms of top commodities? Do you have any predictions? I think you wrote a little bit about some.
Well, I do need to preface all this by saying I'm not an economist or a financial analyst. I'm just...
But you spent 2 years doing research.
I did. I did. So based on that obsessive research, what I can predict is this. I do think that there's no way that we're going to see commodities continue to be solely focused on American eating habits, even though they're traded in the U.S. Just like we're talking about how emerging markets are where we're going to be seeing the explosive population growth, it's my belief that we're going to start seeing commodities trade on more of a global basis. And we've been talking a lot about all the different commodities that went away, the egg futures, the pork belly futures. And to me, one of the more interesting questions is, okay, so what's going to be new? What are we going to be trading in 10 years, 20 years that we're not trading now?
Yeah, you have in the last chapter of the book, which is titled the Future of Food Futures, ? I love that. I can see the whole honey. I can see the honey thing. I mean, you know, the honey. And what's very interesting, you had fish. I'm just shocked that fish was never really one of those traded commodities.
We have traded shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had fish-related futures trading elsewhere in the world. We've had fish meal trading. But we haven't really had specific, like we never had salmon futures, to my knowledge.
Interesting. And why on the list cassava?
Well, that one I'm kind of going out on a limb. I mean, that list is kind of a thought on why this or that might trade. I think cassava might be kind of a far cry. You're smiling, though. There's a personal connection there?
No personal connection. I just think that all the other ones, I'm like, interesting. Cassava. I mean, it's the world's largest producer. They produce cassava in Nigeria and Thailand. Those are the largest exporters are Thailand and Vietnam. I believe it. I totally believe it. I do agree wholeheartedly with this whole food and the globalization and people looking at food and commodities in a very global way. One of the huge food trends, you know, at the end of this year and going into 2013, it's like people looking at Latin food and other food outside of, you know, the American cuisine. So I can see that happening.
I mean, I think even, for example, some of the products that are trading now, coffee is a perfect example. You have Starbucks opening new outlets in China. It seems like every 5 minutes. They have a very aggressive plan for expanding into China. Now, why wouldn't coffee futures become more global? Why would they just trade in New York? There probably ought to be a fully global way to trade coffee based on something like that.
I'm totally, your whole list, I'm like, yeah, I can see that. Totally, I can see that. So speaking of the future, what's next for you? This was your first radio stop promoting your book.
Yes.
Where else will we see you in the coming weeks and in 2013?
Well, on December 8th, I'll be at the New York Public Library giving what they call an illustrated talk, meaning there are going to be pictures involved.
Oh, cool. There are great illustrations in the book, by the way.
Aren't there?
Yeah, you did a great job with that. I love that.
Thank you. One of my favorite images in here is the American Liquor Exchange.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Of course.
I think has been pretty much lost, but I found a private collector who happened to have this photo, and that led me down the rabbit hole to do some more research on that. And I couldn't believe that it ever existed. There were these guys right after Prohibition, just a bunch of guys sitting in a boardroom overlooking Park Avenue, setting all of the prices for wine and liquor after the repeal of Prohibition.
Right up your alley, huh?
You know
that
it.
That research. And look, I have to say this. You're going to have to come back on the show. Congrats on this book. This is like the third book you worked on, right?
This is number two.
This is number two, but you're coming out with number three in 2013, right?
I am. In the spring, I have a book coming out called Cocktails for a Crowd. and that's all about large format drinks for entertaining.
Oh, I can't wait for that. I can't wait. Congrats, Kara. Thank you for coming on Hot Grease.
Thank you so much.
And folks who are listening to Hot Grease, if they want to follow you on Twitter and all those other places, you are Kara Newman, right?
That's all. K-A-R-A-N-E-W-M-A-N.
There you have it, folks. Thanks so much, Kara. We'll see you soon.
Yes, please.
Listeners, thanks so much for listening to Hot Grease on Heritage Radio Network. Remember, you can join me here live every Monday at 3:30 Eastern Time. But until then, always take the road less traveled.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.